Hello and welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. My name is Wolfgang Vashaw. I've long had an interest in, and many questions about, a process called Youth Participatory Action Research, or YPAR. This past June, I was at a Pedagogy and Theater of the Oppressed conference held in Berkeley, California. On the last day, I attended a packed session on YPAR. The session was inspiring, informative, engaging, and fun. A session on research that is fun is a research method that needs to be discussed more. After the session, I spoke with T, one of the presenters, and asked him to come on the podcast. T invited his co-presenter and co-researcher, Dion. The two of them are here today to talk with me about youth participatory action research. Welcome, Dion and T.
Hey, Wolfgang.
Hey.
Nice to have you both here. Both of you are part of an organization called the Ella Baker Center, based in Oakland, California. Can you tell me a little bit about what the center is and what it does?
Well, basically what the Ella Baker Center is a social justice nonprofit in Oakland that has four different campaigns.
Okay.
One of them off the top of my head is Books Not Bars, and they do a lot of work around the juvenile justice system.
Another one is Green Collar Jobs.
And another one is called Soul of the City. And I'm not completely sure of the exact work that they do, but we're part of the Heal the Streets campaign. And that's where we do the YPAR, and it's mostly youth.
What is the Heal the Streets campaign?
It's the campaign that works closely with youth and basically trying to address the issue of violence in Oakland. And each year we work on a different a subject or topic in the community. Last year we worked on racial profiling, and this year we worked on stereotypes and money being worshipped as power.
How did each of you become involved in Heal the Streets?
This is my second year with Heal the Streets, and I got involved through an advisor at my school. She emailed me and was like, "There's this great opportunity for you to be a part of something outside of school." I went online and I filled out the application. Didn't know anything about the organization. I just knew that it was recommended by my advisor. And so I applied, and then I went to the interview, and I met the supervisor. Her name was Krista Lee. She was the supervisor at the time, and she was really amazing. I got accepted, and that's how I got into it.
What was amazing about Krista?
Oh, her name was Krista Lee. She was one of those people, like, as soon as you see her, you can, like, feel her positive energy. Like, she greeted me with, like, the biggest smile that I've ever seen. And I don't know, she was really nice and polite, and she's one of those people that you kind of fall in love with immediately.
And how about you, Dion? How did you get involved with Heal the Streets?
I also got involved with Heal the Streets by the same advisor at our high school. After hearing T talk about the project that they were doing, I got more interested in it and wanted to help the community and everything. And the topic that they were working on really hit home for me because my family had, you know, been racially profiled and everything.
What was it about what T was saying that you thought, oh, I want to be part of that?
Just how he described how they worked on the project, how they actually, like the youth group actually designed the project and designed how they wanted to address the issues in the community, that really interested me, opposed to having an adult, you know, guide us and tell us what to do.
How does the youth determine what projects that you guys are going to work on?
It's usually by consensus. Most of our decisions are made through consensus. And we have a really cool method. When you were a part of our presentation that we did at the conference, you got a sneak preview of how we came up with, like, our research topic and stuff. Basically, we wrote poetry. We marked down the similarities between each person's poem and the issues that were there. And then we identified the two main ones, which were stereotyping and money being, like, worshipped.
The line that you guys start with in your own workshops is, "If the streets of Oakland could speak, they would say." And what would the streets of Oakland say if they could speak?
Don't have a poem on me right now, but the streets of Oakland have witnessed a lot of violence in the community. The streets of Oakland have definitely witnessed a lot of violence from our law enforcement as well, which is really scary, you know, which is a big issue in the community. And we also see most of the problems with violence stem from money. And so if the streets of Oakland could talk, I think that they would most definitely tell you to stop putting so much value in money, especially when it's not worth much. In a literal sense, too, you know, the American dollar has lost its value, but it's still like overvalued, and I think the streets of Oakland would be really sad about that.
Dion, why do you think money is so worshipped
I think just with the how society is and how the media portrays money and like it is being glamorous and everything, I think a lot of youth and younger people in our community look up to those things.
During the process of your latest research project, what are you finding about young people's attitudes towards money, young people who live in Oakland?
They're still in process. We're still in the analytical stage.
I think just off top, one that I remember, a lot of youth, they felt that people were, they get jealous when other people have more money than them. That creates, you know, creates violence.
Is there a recognition from the young people in Oakland that this, the money and violence are connected and that it's hurting them and it's hurting the community?
I didn't find that in any of our research. I think so, but none of our data supports that.
What is your data supporting around young people's attitudes towards money and violence in that relationship? I know it's early days of the research still, or early days of the analysis still.
Yeah, we still are in that stage. But I can share a quote with you from a youth that we had took part that we took from one of our videos during one of our foreign theater skits. And he said, "We live in a society based on competition. We are taught to be jealous, to be individualistic. We don't know how to work as a community and be happy together." I'm pretty sure that that whole competition between people is one of the big causes of the violence in the community, because people don't work together. Instead, they work against each other because somebody's always trying to get ahead of one another, you know?
For sure. I mean, you say in our community, and that's really the opposite of community, right? Trying to put each other down.
Exactly.
Let's take a step back now, because we're starting to go into a bit about the process that you and how you gather data. And let me ask you, what is youth participatory action research?
All right, so I can answer that question, and I'll try to break it up in small parts. What action research is, I went to an action research conference just a few months ago in San Diego, and the most common form of action research was a teacher researching their students on a different educational method, whether it was like problem-based learning through like math or using a Socratic seminar in English class. And so that's what action research is. But what participatory action research is, it's when the stakeholders are the researchers. So those who are affected by the research are the ones who actually do the research. And then you have youth in front of that. So it's basically youth being the stakeholders, researching the issues that affect them.
As adults, often we try to figure out, you know, what's best for young people. And with this assumption that somehow we know what's best for young people, and what you're describing is saying, let's give people tools to let them tell us what's important to them.
Yeah.
And that's a real shift.
It is. It's something that a lot of youth aren't exactly used to either. Because when we start this program, basically, we kind of have two supervisors. We have a mentor, Joshua Bloom, you met him, and we have a consultant. Why did I forget her name?
Lavonna
Saxon. And so basically, there's only two adults amongst 15 other youth. And when we start this process, basically what they say is like, we're going to sit back and let y'all do the work. Y'all are going to decide what's important, and y'all are going to do the research, and y'all are going to analyze it. And we're just here to guide you and give you tools to make that happen. And at first, it's kind of like, wow, you know, I don't have an adult telling me what to do. I feel a little lost, but then you kind of learn to guide yourself through the process.
And what's that like, Dion, to have you doing all the work?
For me, it feels pretty good. Like, just to be able to create something and then see it come alive, I guess. For me, it's pretty interesting, and just to work with different youth that want to help the community and everything.
You mentioned earlier that you did a forum theater piece. Could you explain, Dion, a little bit about what forum theater is?
Forum theater. Basically, when the youth group creates a skit focusing on like the topic that we're working on, which was racial profiling and money being worshipped, and kind of with the skit, they perform it in front of a group of people, usually youth like themselves, and show them what the problem is, and then get, just to collect data, we get interventions, and we re-act out the skit.
So you present situation, a scenario, then people watch it, and then they react it, and then they're allowed to go up and change it. And how they change it is how you collect the data about what's important for the young people?
Yeah.
Nice. I've done forum theater for many, many, many years, and I've never seen it used like that. I think that that's a really innovative, creative way of using forum theater. Dion, you talked about racial profiling as something that, that really resonated for you, and it's something that your family's experienced. In that project of racial profiling, you guys identified four key findings based upon the data that you collected. The four findings are that racial profiling occurs, but it's often underreported. Mm-hmm. The community and police don't have a common definition of what racial profiling is. A lot of police officers believe that racial profiling rarely to never happens.
Mm-hmm.
And racial profiling, when it is done, results in hurt feelings and losing trust between the community members and police officers.
Right.
How did you come to those findings?
Once we did the actual focus groups with youth who had been affected by racial profiling, we took different quotes and kind of with those quotes, we analyzed them and came up with, you know, main ideas. After we interviewed the police officers, we did the same thing.
What was it like to interview police officers?
At first, it was intimidating because just growing up, I was under the impression that, you know, I wasn't supposed to get along with the police. Like, we weren't supposed to have a relationship. So just going into that room with another youth, just me and the other youth and the police officer, it was really scary. But after just going out of the interview, I was more confident with talking with police officers because the first police officer I worked with, they were really open to hearing about racial profiling and working with me.
Why do you say that you were taught not to talk with the police? Tell me more about that if you can.
I think just with one experience with a police officer, my brother, he was harassed for no reason by a police officer on the 4th of July. And we were just outside celebrating everything. And the police came and, like, arrested him. And, you know, he hadn't done anything. He was cleaning up all the fireworks and everything, the sprinklers that we had, sparklers. And they put him in the car, like they arrested him and they put him in the car and they even had him in the car for like 20 to 30 minutes and they just stood there. And for me, like my brother hadn't done anything and that was hurtful for me to see that when I was young at the time. And just with that, like after dealing with that situation, just seeing friends being taken to jail and family members being put in jail, but some were innocent, some weren't, but I feel like with police officers, they treat them wrong because they have the power to.
And do you still think that, having gone through this project?
I think some police officers are like that, but now that after going through this project and going through this process, I'm better able to deal with the police officers. I'm better able to talk with them and code switch and understand that they have a job to do.
The deputy chief in the interview is quoted as saying, "Today the profile in Oakland of a suspect who commits violent assault is 82% of the time an African-American male about 16 to 24 years old. So our officers become conditioned looking for suspects who look like an African-American male about 16 to 24. T, you're an African-American male between 16 and 24. How do you respond when you hear that quote from the deputy chief of police?
It's a little unsettling. It's a little scary. And I feel really uncomfortable all the time when I'm near police officers. Just the other day, you know, this whole I just graduated high school thing, and I wanted to reflect on it. And so, like, it was like midnight, and I decided to go play basketball at a nearby park just to, like, let my thoughts go, you know? And I got approached. A police car was watching me for, like, 5 minutes, and people walk through the park at night and stuff, and these are my community members. These are males, African-American males, 16 through 24, and that doesn't scare me. I feel comfortable and safe with those people, even at the time of midnight. But when a cop car showed up and watched me, like, that was really scary. And then they, like, parked near me. One got out, flashed his flashlight near me, and then he asked his partner to come out, too, and they both came out. And they wanted to ask me a question. They wanted to ask me if I heard gunshots, but I've been out for a while, and I haven't heard any gunshots. But in that whole, like, time period that they were watching me and approaching me, like, that was really scary, you know? And I think it's because, like you said, they are conditioned to look for people that look like me. I have dreads, and most African-American males in Oakland have dreadlocks as well. And so it makes me feel unsafe, not by my community, but it makes me feel unsafe by the law enforcement here because I know that they're looking for people who look like me, and they have biases against that.
Dion, you're doing some really amazing work right now to address some of those biases. Can you tell us a little bit about that work you've done that's come out of the research?
Well, going off of the recommendations that we created last year for our racial profiling report, one recommendation saying that we should make the workshops like Code 33 mandatory for police officers to attend. I went off that and I created a youth and police workshop for my senior thesis project, where basically I had about 7 to 10 youth and 5 to 6 police officers come together and just talk about common experiences with racial profiling and just their daily lives, just so that each, the police and youth can see how each other live and work together to develop ways to better their relationship.
I've been trying to find ways in Toronto for a while to do very similar things to what you've been doing. And I know a lot of other people who've tried to do similar things. So, for example, there was a community here, and the young people were so frightened of meeting with the police that they said, okay, well, we'll meet with them, but we want to wear masks. And the police refused. They wouldn't talk with anybody who's wearing a mask. And the youth were so terrified to not wear masks because they were scared, if they see these police in the community, of what the results would be. How did you manage to get the young people to be there, to be honest, and the police to be there and to listen?
Just with that situation, I had that in mind, with having youth that wouldn't want to participate in the workshop, which is retaliation by the police officers. So with my initial workshop, I had it so that I had youth who are leaders in the community, and then just have police officers, and they develop ways to develop ideas on how to get the youth who are afraid to better that relationship and be around police officers.
And what's been the result?
Just working with Josh and some of the youth who came to the workshop, we kind of created a portfolio where I had all my evidence of the project and all the ideas that the youth created at the workshop, and just some of the ideas that they created would have like more activities that got the youth and police comfortable around each other.
T, have you ever gone to any of the sessions?
Yeah, I've been to the one that that Dion hosted, and it was really cool. And I want to ask you a question as well. For the ones that you tried to make happen, did you make it mandatory for the officers to leave their weapons and to come like dressed as regular people and not in their uniforms?
I had a couple experiences. One, I brought two police officers in to speak with a group of youth that I was working with, and I hadn't thought of these things before. They came in with weapons and in uniform, and it very quickly became a very hostile environment for everybody there. There was about 10 young people, myself, another facilitator, and then the two police officers, and it became quite tense quite quickly. I tried to do a different sort of thing where it wasn't just the police coming and talking to the young people, but it was also the young people sharing their experiences with the police and how they perceive their relationships with the police, and the police that I spoke with weren't willing to do it. Why do you think leaving the guns and the uniforms behind, why do you think that would be important?
It brings a different level, you know, because when you see an officer with their uniform and with a weapon, which is extremely deadly, there immediately becomes this whole this power dynamic that you don't want when you have a circle of people trying to engage in a horizontal dialogue without a hierarchy. But when you have an officer with weapons and uniforms, it seems like more of a vertical dialogue, kind of like what you did the first time where you had the officers only just speak to the youth. And that's not what we wanted at all. We wanted the youth to feel comfortable, and we wanted there to be a more horizontal kind of dialogue. And so we asked them to do that. Of course, they were against it, but through like further persuasion and like knowing some of the right people in the police department, they agreed to that and went really well because of that.
YPAR is youth participatory action research. Those dialogues between young people and officers is an example of action. What other action has come out of your research, your either your first project around teen joblessness or your current one?
So far, no actions have came out of the current one, but we like to think of the Forum Theater or the Theater Press that we've done sort of as an action. The Augusto Boal, the guy who created Forum Theater, he said that the theater itself is not liberatory. It's a practice for the revolution. And so I think giving youth the opportunity to practice dealing with the issues that they go with on a daily basis is kind of an action in itself. We're in the middle of creating a video and then talking about further actions down the road as well. As far as last year's project, Dion's workshops came out of that. And we also, towards the beginning of this year, we also did another workshop previously with cops that I wasn't a part of, but I heard that it went okay, but not too well.
What happened, Dion? Why didn't it go too well the last time?
It was created and hosted by adults. And with the youth that came, they were supposed to get 15 youth and 10 police officers, I think. But it switched. It was 15 police officers there and like 5 youth. And all the police officers came in their uniforms and their guns and everything. And they were sitting at the front of the room. Like, it was pretty intimidating for the youth. With the MCs that were there, they were youth. And they kind of switched it, and the youth were able to talk and, you know, get their voices heard and everything. But it started really bad.
When people hear about the term research, often people will you know, just they're not interested, right? Research sounds like a drag. It sounds tiring. But what you guys are talking about is dynamic. It's interesting. It's leading to changes. It's about issues that matter. What attracted each of you to doing research?
At first, like you said, when you hear the word research, it's like, oh, man, research. I'm going to have to read a lot and analyze a lot of data, and it sounded really boring. But after being a part of the process is when I learned that it's really fun and it's worth doing. Because not only, because like it's easy to go to like government officials and say, this is what's going on with our community, and this is what we don't like about it, and this is what we wanted to change, and this is what we recommend. But it's kind of like you kind of have to speak in their language too, and that's why you have to do a research project, because they need evidence. When we have to workshop with the officers, that's all they cared about. They only cared about what we could prove and like what we had evidence for, as opposed to like emotional evidence, you know, being in the moment and knowing how things felt. And so that's kind of like why like it was really important for me to like stick around and continue these research projects, because I knew that research is pretty much one of the only ways that you can create change in a world where all they care about is like facts and evidence and stuff like that.
Nicely said. Anything you want to add to that, Dion?
Just how they defined research in Hilda Streets was really interesting to me and really different from what I was learning in school and what I had done with research projects at my school.
Levana, one of the two adult guides, says that action research starts by getting your buttons pushed, getting angry, connecting with personal issues, then pushes you to jump outside the box to become the research, to be an I and join with other I's instead of they's, and to take a risk. Together, through our research, we jump off into the unknown to engage with the world in a spiraling process of action and reflection. And through that, we create a youth-led vision for the world we will build. What's the vision of the world the two of you want to build?
So, you know, everybody wants a peaceful world, but, like, what does that mean? And for me, it kind of starts with something new. For example, when I was in the, talking about Dion's workshop with the officers, when I was in that workshop, he was the supervisor of the other officers that were there. And so, you know, he came in late. He missed the whole check-in when we really got to know the officers. And he came in kind of with a chip on his shoulder. And so he was super defensive, and he was like, well, you know, I'm sorry if you want things to just be all, like, glitter and gold, stuff like that. You want things to be fine. That's just not the world we live in, you know. You kind of need force. You need officers, blah, blah, blah. I don't remember his words. That's kind of like a bad paraphrase. But how I responded was that I just have a problem with the law enforcement institution in itself, worldwide, but especially in my community. I think that the entire institution needs something new. I don't know exactly what it needs yet, but it needs something more rehabilitatory. and less violent. I don't think that cops should carry guns ever, and that's my personal opinion. And so, like, a world vision that I kind of see is a world where if an institution says, or if the government says, you know, we don't want the communities to be violent, it's kind of like you need to be the change you wish to see in the world. So I would like the governments not to be violent as well and approach situations in a nonviolent way. So that way the communities can not act violently either. I don't know. I feel like if both parties kind of, it's really tough. I barely know what I'm going with this, but I really want a complete, like, revamping of the law enforcement institution itself.
How about you, Dion?
Like she said, like, you know, with having peace in the world and everything, but I think that with having peace and, like, being able to feel comfortable and be a community, in your community, like, it starts with yourself, and, like, everybody needs to sit down and develop ways to make their lives better and, like, identify what's going on with them and kind of work towards bettering themselves in order to better their community and work with others.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned right at the beginning, and I'm not sure how much you can speak to this because it's not part of your program. The Book Not Bars program at the Ella Baker Center, my understanding from what you said is it's around looking at, instead of prison, let's give young people education. Is that correct?
Yeah.
In the States, and we have it in a different way in Canada, but in the U.S., there's something often called the school-to-prison pipeline. And that's the idea that young people, particularly young people of color, are institutionalized very young. They're not given the opportunities. They're suspended. They're kicked out of school at a disproportionate rate. And they're sort of trained to become criminals rather than trained to become scholars. Do you know how the Ella Baker Center addresses this?
They work closely with the families of these who are incarcerated.
And I don't know if we can go a little off topic from the Ella Baker Center.
Yeah, by all means, go ahead.
So an institution that does work towards what you're saying, more training students to become scholars rather than criminals, is actually the school that we go to. The school that we go to, our theoretical framework is oppression and liberation. So from freshman year to our senior year, that's almost all we learn about. We learn about the societal dynamics that are put in place to keep us from becoming successful, and then we learn learn effective ways to navigate that. And our school is called MetWest. Our school is really profound and does a lot of different work than most of the schools in Oakland and across the country do.
Thank you. I know nothing about MetWest. I will. I'll definitely check it out. Is there anything that I missed that either of you want to speak about before we wrap up?
One thing that I would like to say, and it might be a given, but whenever you do a program like this, it's really important that you build a relationship between the people in the program. Before you start anything, before you start talking about research, you got to make sure that the people that you're going to be with for the duration of the project, you're comfortable with, and that you trust with personal stuff, you know? And so that's always really important, just getting the people you're going to be working with really well.
How did you guys build that trust?
We built that trust through dyads, through the poetry. One important dyad that I remember is tell your life story in a minute. And you have the options to go as deep as you want and not as deep if you like. But I remember going as deep as I could. It was the most of my life that I've ever told anybody that I barely knew in 1 minute. And the fellow, the youth fellow that I did that with, her name is Ayana. And we're pretty close now. Thanks to that.
Yeah, relationship is so crucial. As I think Dion is trying to build with the conversations, as you're building in your work. I want to thank both of you very, very much for taking the time. Can I end with a quote of one of your poems, T?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Cool.
You wrote a poem called Metal Noose. And the last stanza of the poem reads, Can you liberate the young adults out there and make them aware of the oppression they face? Liberate the parents and provide them with the knowledge and tools to keep their kids safe. Can you? Will you? I'm doing my part because I'm tired of losing. To make a difference, it's your option to choose it. To stop the hanging of lead, metal, and stainless steel nooses. How can we help you liberate other people, T?
Man, can't believe you just to help me liberate my community? Well, the obvious thing would be to, if you're somebody listening who has connections and resources, to definitely contact the Ella Baker Center, donate, or just see how you can get involved in any way, shape, or form. That would be amazing. But also to visit my community and not only get to know like the issues that we have in Oakland, but Oakland is the most beautiful city in the world, in my opinion. And I've lived in about 4 different cities, and this is my favorite one. And so I think to visit and get to know like the youth programs like we're involved in and the numerous other ones and all the positive stuff that goes on here is definitely a way to help. It's definitely a way to help my work, because I don't want people to just see Oakland as the violent community outside, the people that live outside of Oakland, because that's how it's portrayed as, and I want a new light to be shed on the community that I live in. I love Oakland very much.
Well said. Any parting words, Dion?
I just want to thank you for interviewing us and trying to get to know the work that we're doing and everything.
You're very welcome. Thank you both for taking the time, and take care of yourselves.
You too.